Russian drone attacks in Ukraine on Sunday put two people in the hospital.
The Ukrainian Air Force says Russian forces fired 25 Iranian-made Shahed drones along the Danube River in the early hours of the morning, 22 of which were shot down by air defenses.
Plus, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's seeking strong steps after street demonstrations turned violent in Tel Aviv.
Dozens suffered injuries, including law enforcement, with at least three protesters hit by police gunfire. The day marked one of the most violent street confrontations in Israel among African asylum seekers and migrants in recent years.
Today is Monday, September 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. On Sunday, two people have been put into the hospital following a 3.5-hour Russian drone barrage in Rainy. It's a seaport in Ukraine's Odessa region. Associated Press correspondent Lawrence Brooks starts us off.
The Ukrainian Air Force says Russian forces fired 25 Iranian-made Shahed drones along the Danube River in the early hours of the morning, 22 of which were shot down by air defenses. Ukrainian officials have described the assault as part of a Russian drive to provoke a world food crisis, but Russia's defense ministry has said in a statement that the attack was aimed at fuel storage facilities used to supply military equipment. The attack on the seaport comes a day before Russian President Vladimir Putin is due to meet with his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan to discuss the resumption of the Black Sea grain deal that Moscow broke off from in July. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Sunday that he had decided to replace his defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, setting the stage for the biggest shakeup of Ukraine's defense establishment since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February of 2022. Elsewhere, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that he is seeking strong steps, including deportation after street demonstrations turned violent in Tel Aviv. Rival Eritrean factions fueled a riot over their homeland's politics with scores of injuries and damage to the community. VOA's Arash Arabasadi is up next.
Clashes turned violent in the streets of Tel Aviv this weekend as hundreds of Eritrean government supporters and opponents hurled rocks at Israeli police officers and smashed business windows. Dozens suffered injuries, including law enforcement, with at least three protesters hit by police gunfire. The day marked one of the most violent street confrontations in Israel among African asylum seekers and migrants in recent years. Saturday's clashes came on the 30th anniversary of the current Eritrean leader's rise to power, with anti-government protesters wearing blue shirts modeled on the country's 1952 flag, a symbol of opposition to the ruling dictatorship. Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu convened a special committee to discuss asylum seekers and migrants.
What happened yesterday crossed a red line. This is rioting. It is bloodshed. It is savageness that we cannot accept. We are seeking strong steps against the rioters, including the immediate expulsion of those who took part. It's hard for me to understand why we would have a problem with those who declare that they support the regime. They certainly cannot claim refugee status.
Netanyahu noted that Israel's Supreme Court earlier struck down some legislative measures designed to coerce the migrants to leave. For those who sought a life in Israel free from the dictatorship in Eritrea, the violence fosters uncertainty in an adopted homeland.
So that has left us shaken. We are ashamed and we're hurting. We're hurting, and we're also afraid and feel insecure in the country. We ran away from persecution in our country, and the dictator regime continues to persecute us, to silence us.
Eritreans account for the majority of the more than 30,000 African asylum seekers in Israel. Saturday's violent clashes came during what is now Israel's 35th consecutive week of mass protests following overhauls early in 2023 weakening the country's judiciary. Netanyahu's coalition of hard-right conservatives stripped the Supreme Court of oversight on his government. Israelis say the move is a step toward dictatorship, with some calling it a coup. Supporters of the legislation argue the judicial measures reinstate a balance of power in government branches. Critics say the measures do away with checks and balances. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Central African merchants and Gabon civilians who were stranded in a southern Cameroonian city are pleased that Gabon's military is reopening the borders that were sealed after a coup removed Gabon's president, Ali Bongo, from power last week. We hear next from Moki Edwin Kinzika.
Scores of traders at a popular spot in Kiosi on Cameroon's southern border with Gabon and Equatorial Guinea say they are happy Gabon's new leadership has ordered the reopening of its borders. The traders are from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and the Central African Republic. On Saturday, Gabon's military junta said it was reopening the borders 3 days after closing them during a military coup in which President Ali Bongo Ondimba was ousted. 26-year-old Gabonese truck driver Ngaya René, who has been stranded in Cameroon, says he is waiting for border troops to respect the military ruler's instructions and reopen the border so he can be with his family in Gabon's capital, Libreville.
Il faut être transparent dans la façon de les gérer.
Ngaya says he came to Cameroon to buy spare motor parts but could not return because the border was sealed. Ngaya says his wish is for the new leadership in Gabon to create jobs for civilians, especially young people who live in misery. Several Gabon government troops are still stationed on Gabon's side of the border. Hundreds of vehicles and trucks are stationed on both sides. Gabon's leaders said on state TV that land, sea, and air borders were opened because the junta wants to preserve the rule of law and maintain good relations with their neighbors and all countries of the world. Kosok Pierre is a lecturer at the Omar Bongo University in Libreville. He says the border closure and curfew in Gabon were part of security measures taken to protect the country from any potential embarrassing situation after Ali Bongo was ousted. He says Gabon's government should keep a watch over its borders by allowing troops to decide who comes and goes.
Ceux qui ont gouverné ce pays,
Kosok says it would be very wrong to think that Ali Bongo and his father Omar Bongo rules Gabon for over 56 years and do not have friends who benefited from the oil-producing nation and want the Bongo dynasty to hold on to power. Kosok says civilians and the military massively support changes in Gabon's leadership, and the Central African state is taking precautions should any attempt be masterminded in a neighboring state to bring back Bongo. In 2019, Gabon closed border crossings with neighboring Cameroon after rebel troops appeared on state television announcing they had staged a coup against President Ali Bongo to restore democracy. The government of Gabon later said it had regained control and arrested seven rebel soldiers. Gabon held elections on August 26, with Ali Bongo running for re-election. Contested results indicate 69-year-old Abed Ondo Osa, a former minister and university professor, won the poll. But Gabon's Center for Elections declared Ali Bongo the winner with 64% of the vote. Amid the confusion, Gabon's military announced it had seized power and placed Ali Bongo under house arrest. It's not known how long it will take to clear the backlog of vehicles stranded at the borders once everything is operational and moving again. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Kiosi, Southern Cameroon.
And meanwhile, thousands of demonstrators in Niger on Sunday were holding a third day of rallies calling for former colonial ruler France to withdraw its troops, and sought by the junta, which also seized power at a coup in July. Territorial disputes in the South China Sea, an ongoing crisis in Myanmar, and the war in Ukraine are some of the key issues that will be addressed by Vice President Kamala Harris at the next summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, next week in Jakarta, Indonesia. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittigaswara has that story.
When Vice President Kamala Harris was in Southeast Asia last year, in a rebuke to Beijing, she stopped by Palawan Island in the Philippines, just 330 kilometers east of the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. In Jakarta, Indonesia next week, to meet leaders of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, Harris will also discuss this vital maritime route, where there are overlapping claims by China, Taiwan, and four ASEAN members, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei.
You can expect the Vice President to discuss the South China Sea as well. Throughout her meetings in Jakarta, a couple of things. She will reaffirm our support for the freedom of the seas, peaceful resolution of disputes, and adherence of international law, including freedom of navigation.
Other key topics include the crisis in Myanmar, where thousands have been killed and millions displaced since the 2021 military coup. ASEAN has failed to compel its members to return to democracy, as have various international sanctions, including from the U.S.
In Myanmar, we must press the military regime to stop the violence, to implement ASEAN's five-point consensus, to support a return to democratic governance.
Harris is also expected to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As is the case with Myanmar and the South China Sea, ASEAN's reaction has been muted, expressing only concerns about the fallout of the war without denouncing Russia, a key arms supplier in the region. Some in the region will also question why it is Harris, not President Joe Biden, who is attending.
Maybe it is a slap for Indonesia because if we see Indonesia flagship program for the summit, actually in ASEAN Indo-Pacific Forum, and it will not be attended by the U.S.
Leaders' meeting in Jakarta will also deal with another key challenge. The Indonesian capital has been one of the world's top most polluted cities this month as authorities grapple with a spike in toxic smog. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Bill Richardson was a two-term Democratic governor of the state of New Mexico, as well as an American ambassador. He died on Friday. The AP's Jackie Quinn has this look back at the impact he had on American foreign policy.
The Richardson Center for Global Engagement says 75-year-old Bill Richardson died in his sleep at his home in Chatham, Massachusetts. Richardson was regarded around the world as an ambassador and negotiator, recently involved in the release of Brittany Griner from Russia. He described himself as the informal undersecretary for thugs. And he wasn't afraid to criticize presidents like Donald Trump's fire and fury policy on North Korea in 2017.
I thought the president's remarks were not on target, were unfortunate, but they're done.
His office says the world has lost a champion for those held unjustly abroad. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The Australian Antarctic Program says the researcher's family is being kept informed of the situation. Hundreds of supporters of Seed Movement, or Movimiento Semilla, took to the main plaza in Guatemala City on Saturday to protest attempts to overthrow the government of President-elect Bernardo Arevalo. Before he could take office, Arevalo called on his countrymen to resist what he said was a coup d'etat. Swedish police on Sunday arrested two people and detained about 10 others after a violent riot broke out at a protest involving a Quran burning. The protest, which was organized by Iraqi refugee Salwan Mamika, sparked outrage across the Middle East. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Currently, the odds seem high for an election rematch between incumbent U.S. President Joe Biden and his predecessor, Donald Trump. However, some politicians are leaving the door open to entering the race. VOA's Veronica Balderos Iglesias has the story.
He now has a mugshot and an inmate number in the latest of several legal probes he faces. But former President Donald Trump is adamant he didn't do anything wrong, and several polls show that as of now, he isn't losing any supporters. In fact, many of his contenders for the 2024 presidential Republican nomination have said they'd back him if he were to win it. One of them is Vivek Ramaswamy, who told ABC's This Week that he supports Trump even as he disagrees with some of the choices the latter made while in office.
I think that many of these prosecutions against Donald Trump are downright politicized persecutions through prosecution that set an awful precedent for our country. I do not want to see us become a banana republic where the administrative police state uses police force to eliminate opponents from competition.
Support pledges for Trump made by his Republican presidential contenders were strongly criticized by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who was also interviewed on ABC.
If you are unwilling to say that the behavior of Donald Trump trying to overturn the peaceful transfer of power is a disqualifier, if you pledge despite that to vote for him, if you pledge despite that to pardon him should you be elected.
As election season gets underway in the United States, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who appeared on NBC's Meet the Press, shared some words of advice for fellow Republicans who, like him, reject the Trump brand and worry about some political gains that Democrats are already making at the local level in some states, including New Hampshire.
You don't make things personal. You do things that are clearly in the best interest of the constituents you serve, regardless of party. Now, I'm a staunch fiscal conservative, and I want to support Republican ideals, but that doesn't mean we're going to bend and break rules.
Even as the current spotlight is on a possible presidential election rematch between Trump and the incumbent president, Joe Biden, a third-party run could alter the race. Maryland's former Republican governor, Larry Hogan, was asked about his political ambitions during his appearance on CBS's Face the Nation.
I have not closed the door to that. If I believe that we can actually win the race, we have a strong ticket, that those two major candidates are weak, we might have to try to pull off something that's never been done.
Analysts point out that the general election is still more than a year away, and that other factors besides Trump's legal woes and Biden's age could sway the American votes. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
In 1945, American forces invaded the Japanese island of Okinawa, triggering one of the bloodiest land battles of the Pacific. A man who has spent decades looking for the remains of those killed fears Okinawa is again vulnerable as tensions rise between China and the United States, which has about 30,000 troops on the island. Henry Ridgewell brings us that story.
The jungle caves of Okinawa hide the remains of thousands of civilians and soldiers, those who died in the last major battle of World War II.
Scar.
Holding up a piece of blackened bone, Gushiken Takamatsu, the founder of the organization Gamma Fuya, said, "It's a piece of a skull. Is this dead person a soldier or a civilian? I think it was a flamethrower that did this. Everything is burned." For decades, the bones have lain undisturbed as Japan tried to forget its wartime past. That shames the nation, says Gushiken Takamatsu. The Okinawan native founded the organization Gamma Fuya, or Cave Digger, a small group of volunteers dedicated to finding the remains of wartime dead and reuniting them with their living descendants. Takamatsu said, "When I was young, I would see skeletons wearing steel helmets when I went out to play in the mountains. When I was a kid, it was just scary. But as I got older and matured, I wondered why the victims of this war were still left there." Through 40 years of searching, Takamatsu has discovered the remains of over 700 people. The Japanese government does not provide financial help. In 2011, it agreed to offer selective DNA testing, but the database is small and many relatives of the dead have likely also died. Takamatsu said, "We are one or two volunteers. In reality, the government should be doing this, but even though we ask, they refuse. I want to show that if you look for the remains in this way, you can find them. This work isn't finished yet." So far, Takamatsu has identified the remains of four people and reunited them with their surviving relatives. They didn't believe me at first, he said. They were suspicious and thought it was a scam. But I understand how they felt. For 70 years, they didn't hear anything. And then they get a phone call to say their relative had been found. It was like their father was coming home. Around 90,000 Japanese soldiers and 12,000 US troops were killed as American forces stormed Okinawa in April 1945. It's estimated that over 100,000 civilians were killed. Local inhabitants were told that they would be beaten and murdered by US forces. Many hid in the island's caves. Surrender was forbidden. Some committed suicide. The US and Japan are now close allies. Okinawa hosts almost 30,000 American troops. A new American base is being built on the east coast of the main island. Some of the earth used in the construction is being excavated from the south of Okinawa, where US forces came ashore in 1945. Local authorities insist the material is screened before it is dug up, but Takamatsu says it likely contains the remains of Japanese and American soldiers. If there is a war, this place will be attacked. That's what bothers me the most, Takamatsu said. Searching through the caves, Takamatsu is not only trying to heal the wounds of Okinawa's past, but also protesting war in general, as the danger of conflict once again edges closer to these islands. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Okinawa, Japan.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America, and on behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The decision by the transition government in Mali to close the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, or MINUSMA, has already triggered renewed violence on the ground, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
We are alarmed by a resumption of hostilities in northern Mali, including by violations of the ceasefire during the August 11th and 12th clashes at the Bear Camp, and by subsequent attacks on a MINUSMA convoy on August 13th. Additionally, MINUSMA's withdrawal limits the ability of the international community to protect civilians from the predations of Wagner, whose activities contribute to greater insecurity in the country.
Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield expressed her gratitude to the men and women of MINUSMA and to the troop and police contributing countries for their commitment to peace in Mali in the face of grave danger.
And we strongly condemn senseless attacks on peacekeepers, which threaten to reverse years of progress toward peace and stability and undo so many of the remarkable gains made by the UN and Malians.
The Malian people deserve peace, declared Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. And further instability would open the doors to JNIM and ISIS Sahel to spread their access and influence. It would be a recipe for disaster. The Malian transition government and signatory armed groups, along with the UN and the international community, must demonstrate a revitalized commitment to the Algiers Accord, urged Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield.
This agreement continues to represent the best opportunity for lasting peace and stability in Mali, plain and simple. To that end, we call on all signatory parties to immediately renew their cooperation with the international mediation.
The United States urges the parties to settle their disputes through dialogue and engage with MINUSMA on an agreement for the safe and peaceful transfer of its camps and bases to the Malian authorities. As the situation grows increasingly volatile, these transfers must prioritize the safety and security of peacekeepers. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield reminded the transition authorities that the Status of Forces Agreement and its provision ensuring MINUSMA's freedom of movement throughout Mali remains in full effect until the mission's final element has departed, which will extend beyond December 31st. Mali's leaders have an opportunity to build on MINUSMA's legacy and recommit to dialogue to settle differences rather than violence. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield urged all Malians to choose the path of peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.